This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about everything related to contractors, construction, and information to help you run better businesses.
Hello, guys. This is Carolyn Cromings, and welcome back to the Quit Getting Screwed podcast, where we talk about all the ways not to get screwed in the construction industry and help you guys run a better business. And so today is a topic that I know is important, but I'm not familiar with at all. So I brought on an industry expert, which is the topic of intellectual property, IP, which means copyright, trademark, patent, trade secrets, and all that kind of stuff, and how that affects your construction business and kind of what you need to be aware of. So I'm very interested to learn as well. And I have Brian Cruz from Hurtado Zimmerman out of Wisconsin. And so welcome to the show, Brian. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So before we dive into this, tell us a little bit about yourself and kind of how you got into construction law, and then specifically, how do you know so much about IP and construction?
Sure. So I'm a shareholder with Hurtado Zimmerman. I've been practicing since 2013 with this firm. And prior to practicing law, I was both a touring musician and a construction worker. Basically, when I was off the road touring, I would work in construction. So I had feet in both industries and was able to then use my connections and my knowledge in both of those industries to create my practice, which currently is construction, real property, some municipal bond finance, and then also entertainment law. The intellectual property side of things really came from my interest in entertainment, because with copyrights, a lot of those issues arise in the entertainment sphere. We also have a little bit in trademarks, not so much in patents though. But then as I started practicing construction law, I discovered fairly quickly that not a lot of my clients were too aware of intellectual property considerations and how they could leverage those and use those to build their business and also protect their business. And so I started to integrate a lot more of those considerations into my discussions and my work with my clients.
So I know I kind of went over the intellectual property, but can you tell us like what they are specifically and what the difference between all of them are?
Sure. So there really are four main types: copyright, trademarks, patents, and trade secrets. Patents are something that I do not do. Typically, you have to have an engineering background to do that and pass a separate bar, but those cover inventions or methods of doing things generally. Trade secrets, best example of a trade secret is the KFC recipe, maybe the Coca-Cola recipe, something that a company will keep a secret and not let anybody except for a few select folks know about. And they get protection over that thing, whatever it may be, by virtue of keeping it secret. You can't register a trade secret. It's just a secret because it's a secret. Copyright is a federal protection, and that arises for things like literature, music, also sound recordings of music, plays, choreography, and then as it relates a lot to construction firms, architectural works and depictions of architectural works. And trademarks are source identifiers. So and what I mean by a source identifier is something that tells the public where something is coming from, whether it's a good or a service. And you're going back to my example of KFC or Coca-Cola, those are trademarks of those companies. They tell you that every time you grab a can of Coca-Cola, you know that you're getting a Coke. It's going to be the same, it's going to taste the same, and there's that brand identity.
Gotcha. So why should construction companies and contractors care about intellectual property and those things you just described?
Sure. Yeah. So we can go into each of the areas and specifically talk about how each one will apply with a little bit more detail. But in general, it's an added layer of protection to how exactly you're operating your business. You have a name, likely, that you're using. Maybe it's your family name, maybe something that you crafted to be marketable in the marketplace. Maybe it has to do with your geographic designation, and you want to protect that name. Side note, generally geographic designations are not something that you can trademark, but we can talk about that in a little bit. With copyright, you have your architectural works. If you're a design build firm, you may have architectural works that you want to protect, but you also have all of your marketing materials that you want to protect. Also, you are going to be creating things by virtue of your job and your building that are protectable. Photos, videos, fly-throughs, any kind of website content. Maybe you have a jingle that you created and it was a work for hire. So all of those things help to build your brand. And if you start to let go of those things that build your brand, you start to cede control to someone that's not you. But if you can control them and keep them, well, then you have a brand. You can continue to build your brand and you can continue to market your brand to the public.
Gotcha. So let's dive into the first one that we talked about, copyright. So what exclusive rights does a copyright owner have?
Sure, sure. So the Copyright Act lets you reproduce, prepare derivative works, which is just something that's, you could think of maybe a sequel from a movie is really a derivative work, distribute copies, or assign or display what you have. So if you're talking about an architectural work, you can sell that work to somebody else. You can license that work. You would essentially retain the ownership rights in that work, but then license it to somebody to use to build. You could display it to everybody that wants to see it. You could use it in marketing. And you could also, when I say derivative works, a good example is maybe you had an architectural work that you created that was a very unique configuration of a building, and maybe the company that hired you to do it wanted version two. Maybe they had a next door neighbor a neighboring property that they were going to build on, and they wanted one that looked kind of like it, but maybe a little bit different, but at least stayed within that general aesthetic. So those are your basic rights in copyright.
Gotcha. And so how do you obtain that copyright protection?
It's a little bit of a unique process in that the moment that you've created something and fixed it in a tangible format, it is automatically afforded copyright protection. That's the way the law is written. And it's a little strange because the only person who would ever know that you created this and that it's done and that it's got that copyright protection is you. So theoretically, there are millions of works out there right now that the only person or the only entity that knows that thing, whatever it may be, is copyrighted is the person who created it. You can take another step, though, and that's registering your copyright. It's no longer required. It used to be required, but it isn't anymore. And you do that by going to the Copyright Office and submitting an application. The application has some very basic information, when it was created, who is asserting copyright protection, and then they usually require a deposit copy of whatever it is that you are submitting. So in the case of an architectural work, the plan set, or a depiction of whatever it is. You can also, if you're talking about a sound file, upload a sound file. If you're talking about an image, upload the image. And then there's a brief turnaround period where the Copyright Office will look at the material that you've submitted, determine whether or not it is actually copyrightable, and if it is and it passes their review, then you're granted a certificate. And that certificate is your evidence that whatever that thing is that you created is actually copyrighted. And there's also a database that's created that's publicly searchable that posts all of these things. So at that point, now everybody knows. If you say, hey, I had my architectural work here, and I know previously nobody knew that it was copyrighted, but now as of this date, it's been copyrighted. You can direct somebody to that website, you can direct them to the certificate, and that's your prima facie evidence that it's yours.
So that's a benefit of having it copyrighted, as opposed to, because technically what you're saying is a copyright exists whether you're registered or not, right?
Correct.
Which means it's protected from somebody else using it, but then you would still have to prove that you were done with it and it was your work, right?
Correct. Yeah, and that comes up quite a bit that scenario you're talking about can come up quite a bit because, say, for example, architects that I've worked with, I always will recommend that they copyright their work or design build firms. I will always recommend that they copyright their work. Very rarely do they actually file that registration because it's an extra cost. Now, they could adjust their pricing and build that cost in there. And the fees that the copyright office takes vary based on what you're registering. It's not a lot, but most people don't actually register that. But then if there is a dispute and somebody rips off one of your designs, then you have this uphill battle to show that it's actually yours. And you have to do that using whatever information you have available to you. Now, the nice thing is everybody works on computers now, and there are last revisions saved. So you can go back and say, well, look, I started working on this thing on such and such a date. And I made a revision here, I made a revision here, and I made a revision here. And then I sent it to so-and-so on this date, because here's an email. And so you build your case doing that. But somebody else could come up with some sort of other evidence that they also independently created something, and now you're disputing it. So a nice thing about registration is it is that prima facie evidence that it's yours. Another benefit of registration is that if you have to sue somebody for copyright infringement, you can get your attorney's fees. Now, attorney's fees can be massive in any litigation. I'm sure on this podcast you've talked about attorney's fees, but you never know. I mean, they could be a minimal amount if things get resolved early, or they could be hundreds of thousands of dollars if things get resolved after a prolonged litigation. If you don't have a registration of your copyright and you have been infringed upon, you can't get your attorney's fees. But if you do register, attorney's fees are something you can get. And the other benefit is actual damages versus statutory damages. So if you don't register, you only get actual damages. If you do register, you get statutory damages. And statutory damages can vary depending on the nature of the infringement, but it's a fixed amount and something that you're guaranteed. Whereas if you have to prove actual damages, it's, again, an uphill battle. For example, say somebody takes your architectural work, copies it, sends it to a planning commission, and it gets wrapped up in the planning commission somewhere, and there's a problem with how it's going forward. So you're on this cusp of maybe there's damages, but you can't yet prove it. You can't yet prove a monetary loss. Well, in that case, it's very possible that your damages are zero. And you may be filing a lawsuit to get $0 of damages if you haven't registered your work. Whereas if you have registered your work, and then you can prove intent possibly if there's a trail, you can assert a fixed amount of damages. And so that's another benefit. So the big takeaways are, and I say this about pretty much everything, is that it helps to do a little bit of pre-planning, which I know tends to be the nature of this podcast, is if you can prepare first, copyright your work, register it, you're setting yourself up for a lot less of an uphill battle and a lot less of a headache on the back end.
So a couple of questions. So copyright law is federal law, right?
Correct.
So that means it applies to all the states the same?
Correct.
Okay, second question. Where is the copyright office? Is it a place I have to go to, or can I do it online?
So the copyright office is located, it's a physical place, but you don't have to go there to register. You can go there and search through their files if you are interested, and it's in DC. Mm-hmm. But if you want to go register your work, you go to the copyright office's website. You can just Google copyright office. And it will take you through a almost a wizard type of program. Basically, it makes you create a login first. Or if you're working with an attorney, the attorney may already have a login. I know for a lot of the work that I do for my clients, I have my single login, and then I just register on behalf of my clients. And then I can also maintain my entire docket that way. But if you're going to do it on your own, you register. And then you fill in all the information that's requested in this wizard type program that goes along and takes you through all of the various pieces of information that you need, like your name and what type of work it is, and you're uploading your specimen.
Gotcha. Okay, so how long does the copyright protection last once you register it?
So if you are again, this is something that varies, but if it's a single work created by a single person, say you created a photograph of something. We've been talking about architectural works. Let's talk about photos. You built a project and you have some photos of it and you took the photo of your own project. That's going to be 70 years from the end of the life of you. So say you die tomorrow, 70 years from tomorrow, that work is outstanding and has copyright protection. If there are more than one people or who created something, it is the latter of the two's life. So say the first person passes away tomorrow, the next person lives another 50 years. Well, you're going to get an extra 50 years plus the day after that 70. Person passes away, another 70 after that.
Wow.
If it's a work for hire, then, and we can talk about work for hire in a little bit, but then that's a longer period.
So let me ask you an attorney question. So if you have a copyright, is that, and you file this action, is that something you could win like on a summary judgment or as a matter of law, like a quick resolution, or would it still take a while if you have the copyright protection?
Well, theoretically, if you can prove that the thing that you have is the same as what's been infringed, you could potentially win on a summary judgment motion action or a summary judgment motion. There is a new mechanism that's been created that just started up last year under what's called the CASE Act. And it's a small claims alternative to large claims actions. Now, I haven't personally tried it. I know that it's a tribunal that's starting to ramp up. But the theory behind it is that smaller companies can appear either by attorney or pro se, which is nice,
really? Huh.
And potentially get a quicker resolution to their matter at a cheaper cost. There are dollar amount restrictions that are attached to it. And I have not, it's too new. I haven't used it and I haven't had a client who's needed to use it yet. And I haven't really heard a lot of feedback about how it's been used, especially in the construction industry, but it's something that's out there and it's a potential avenue.
Gotcha. So I know we went over some things, but is there anything else that we didn't mention that would specifically benefit a construction company to use copyrights?
Yeah. So we talked about architectural works and there's actually two components to that. There's the overall design that you can register, but you can also register individual technical sheets. So the overall design would be one fee. Say it's one work created by one person, it's a $45 fee. But if you're doing individual sheets, then you have to pay a separate fee for each sheet. And the Copyright Office does, in certain circumstances, allow for multiple works to be registered under a single fee. And there's a fee schedule that gets published and updated every once in a while. So I always recommend looking at that fee schedule before you do something, but that's one option. Photos and videos. Before, after, progress photos of any kind of project that you're working on. If you're taking those photos, you are the creator, you are the owner of those photos. And the cool part about that is you can use that on your own marketing material, but you can also maybe license it to somebody else. And by license it, I mean you retain the ownership, you license it, and maybe you can actually get a fee for that if it's something that they want enough. A news source, a magazine, anybody who likes your photo enough and wants to use it, you could potentially get a fee for it. I know a lot of folks do fly-throughs. They've been hiring drone companies. Now, the drone company would likely be the one who owns it. To back up the train a little bit, usually the person who creates the work is the owner of the copyright, except for in a case of work for hire. And this is probably a good time to talk about work for hire. I know we're going to talk about it a little bit later, but we can knock it out right now. Mm-hmm. Work for hire is a term of art, which means that somebody has hired you on to do something. And by virtue of that hiring, you've created something for the person who's hired you that you don't own personally. The company that hired you owns it. And it's actually as if the creator never owned it in the first place. So a lot of bigger companies will A lot of companies will just say anything that our employees create while working for us is a work for hire. And they'll have an agreement that states that. And there's also a provision in there that says that in the event that this agreement shall be determined not to be a work for hire, the works that you created are hereby assigned, transferred in whole for no additional consideration. And then the company owns the work. And so it's as if you as an employee never owned it. The company owns it from inception under a work for hire theory. In that case, when you go to register the work at the Copyright Office, it's not the person who created it claiming ownership, the picture or architectural work or whatever have you is being registered in the name of the company. And then the company maintains that ownership, and then they can license it or use it or distribute it or do whatever they want to with it from that point forward. So using that knowledge, what we just talked about and talking about fly-throughs or hiring people to create things like photos and videos. Maybe you created something, you built a building, and you hired a drone company to fly through. Well, under the Copyright Act, unless there's a work-for-hire agreement, that drone company will own that copyright. So what you want to do is make sure that you have the agreement with the drone company that says that they're getting a fee for doing the fly-through, but you own as a work for hire. Same thing with photographs. If a photographer, a professional photographer, is hired on, they will very often say, well, I own it. I own the photo. And you will want to have an agreement that says that that's a work for hire. And a practice tip is typically the creator isn't going to offer that up. You're going to have to ask for it.
Well, because I've read a lot of contracts where the creators actually say, I created it, even though you're paying me, I'm keeping it.
Absolutely.
Is that legal? Can I do that?
Yeah. Yeah, they can absolutely do that. And that's why I was saying is they typically don't offer it up because there's no incentive to.
Yeah.
I mean, the way the Copyright Act is written, they create it, they own it. And unless it's a work for hire, you don't have to do anything else to establish that ownership. If the company wants to assert that ownership, though, then they do have to get some sort of agreement that says that that's being transferred over. Sometimes what that means is that you just pay a higher premium, a buyout rate. And maybe the person who you're hiring will be willing to do that. I have occasionally run into situations where a photographer says, nope, no way, it's mine, and that's what the law says. And in that case, it's a business decision of whether or not you want to work with that photographer and live with that scenario where they own it, own the photograph or the video, and you are simply licensing it from them.
So what cannot receive copyright protection?
So a couple of things that cannot receive copyright protection include ideas. If you come to the table and say, oh, I've got an idea about something, you can't just copyright the idea. You have to copyright the actual tangible expression. Titles. I do have folks that ask me often, well, I've got this really cool title. Can I copyright that? That's not something you can copyright. Names such as the name of your company, that's something that we'll talk about when we're talking about trademarks. Website domains, typically you're not going to be able to copyright those things. One thing that I did want to back up and talk about a little bit that I think we may have skipped over about things that your company could use in the copyright also not only photos and videos, but marketing materials. If you created marketing materials for your website that are copy, well, the copy is technically copyrightable. Presentations, brochures, the way that those things are created. So you've got photos that you've put into copy and put that into a brochure or a website. That whole configuration can be copywritten. I do know some construction companies that write books, entire manuals. Those can be copywritten. And sometimes folks will hire on people to write songs or jingles, and there may be a work for hire situation there too, but those songs and jingles are something that can be that can receive copyright protection.
And what about contracts? Like, especially like I do a lot of residential. I have my own outline for contract that I do for my client. That a lot of people, could I copyright something like that?
So technically, you can copyright a contract. You can copyright a form. The unique configuration of the form. This is and some of the industry contracts like the AIA suite, the Consensus Doc suite, EJCDC, all of those have a little copyright logo on the bottom that say that they're a copywritten product. There are some arguments out there that say that certain things within those contracts you just can't copyright. And this becomes an argument issue. So in a specific indemnity clause that's used consistently may be something that you just can't copyright, because otherwise you'd be recreating the wheel every single time. And case law that's built upon that specific organization of words and commas would be voided every single time somebody reconfigured it just to avoid copyright protection. So that's why I'm saying there are some arguments that specific clauses cannot be cannot receive copyright protection. But the organization can. There was an old case that talked about just a book of blank forms that said that those could receive copyright protection because of the organization. Not just the blank forms themselves, not the boxes, but the organization of them. So that is something that you can look at. And it is something I've also encountered in my own practice. I represented a client years ago who was coming over from one company to another company, and the contracts that were being used between the old company and the new company had some similarities. And so the old company was trying to assert copyright protection over the old forms. And our argument was that the elements that they were asserting weren't necessarily something that you could actually copyright. So we still talked. I still talked with my client, and it's a good practice to talk with your clients, or if you're a contractor, to talk with your attorneys about if you're using somebody else's form, how not to get up in some situation where somebody's asserting that you've ripped it off from them. Maybe that means moving things around. Maybe that means putting your own logo on the top and reorganizing things in a unique way. And realistically, not every contract works for every business. So if you find something online and it's for a roofing company and you're a masonry company, well, you're not going to be having fill in the blanks for shingles and flashing. Yeah. It's not going to work for you. And that's another thing I should say too, is if you find things online, it's not free game. And I know I talk to so many people who say, they say, well, I've got a contract. And I say, okay, great. Where'd you find it? Or who created it for you? Well, I found it on this website, or I found it online. I Googled such and such. And while it may look like a contract, it may not be applicable to your particular situation. And so I always recommend having your attorney look over the contract to make sure that it's applicable to your situation and that it's also enforceable within your jurisdiction, wherever your company is located. A fantastic example of that is on the real estate side of my practice, occasionally I find people will find these form leases, and it'll be a fine lease. I mean, it looks legitimate, but in our state, we have some very specific rules over what can and cannot be in leases and what you can and cannot take out of a security deposit and how that's framed in the context of your lease language. And I've seen all too many times people come to me with a lease that they've been using for years that is per se unenforceable or has provisions in it that make the entire lease unenforceable under Wisconsin law. And there's case law and statutes, there's statutes and then case law interpreting statutes that say that essentially your lease is null. So that there is a danger there in just finding something online and assuming that it's something you can use, not only because of a copyright protection issue, but because of just the way you do your business.
Oh, absolutely. So how do you address copyrights in the contracts with your customers? And then, like, I've seen copyright stuff in, like, contracts that you sign, like a subcontract kind of thing. How do you work with that?
Yeah, so the first thing is to have frank and honest and open discussions with everyone about what you're doing. All too often, I will see people just make assumptions, and that's usually a really bad idea. And then also, have everybody just up front say, okay, who's going to own this design? If it's an architectural work, don't assume and don't feel scared to ask who's going to own the design. Make that be something that you address and make it explicit in the contract. If somebody's coming through to do a photos or fly-throughs for your company, make it clear who's going to own that design. The same thing works for your marketing materials. In building information modeling and then life cycle uses, I've also seen cases where there are copyright considerations for the life of the building. So where an architect may design a building and then they would license that design for the life of the building, or maybe they would just assign it and sell it to the end user for the life of the building for maybe facilities maintenance purposes or operations, and even in some cases, decommissioning purposes. And so making sure that all of those things are adequately addressed in the contract. And recently, there have been a lot more construction contracts that are addressing life cycle concerns. And, we know as of today, this building is going to have a life cycle of 40 years. And so we are going to plan at the end of the 40 years for something to happen to that building. Well, that's something that we know today. And it is something that's becoming more and more prevalent. Well, then let's address how this is all going to work out for that entire period of time. Because it may be possible that at the end of the 40 years, if it's strictly a license, can you reuse that design again at the end of the 40 years? Possibly. Also, if there's something that, if you're decommissioning a building and the architect is claiming a right in it, have you somehow upended their copyrights by destroying their building? Now, that's a little far-fetched, but we have jobs as attorneys because of sometimes things that are just unanticipated. Mm-hmm. And so it's worth having the discussion about how these things are going to be used. And also why I say just don't forget to talk about it. Even if it's a 40-second conversation, address how you're going to deal with your copyright.
A quick question. You gave me the timelines for individual copyright. What about if a company has a copyright? How long is that good for?
Yeah, that should be 95 years.
Okay. Gotcha. Awesome. All right. So did we miss anything on copyrights before we move into trademarks?
No, I think that's about it for for that.
Well, I'm learning a lot. It's all exciting stuff. One attorney question I want to ask, that work for hire stuff, can I put that in with my attorneys too? I know sometimes there's ethical rules that prevent you from restricting the practice rights of attorneys.
Yeah, I would have to defer off to your state bar wherever you're located, because I wouldn't want to have I wouldn't want to run afoul of it.
Well, I understand. Okay, so what can be trademarked? Moving on to trademarks.
So there are, as I said at the beginning of the podcast, anything that's a source designator is something that can be trademarked. So the name of your company is likely the most obvious thing. The USPTO, which is the US Patent and Trademark Office, controls trademarks and the registration of the trademarks. And they've subdivided trademarks into two separate categories, goods and services. So if you're a manufacturer, then you'd likely fall in the goods category. If you're a construction company, you're going to likely fall into the services category. And then there's a number of subcategories within each of these main categories which you may apply. So, you know, you could be a concrete contractor, or you may be a concrete manufacturer, and then you would select the proper area in the goods and services of the USPTO manual to assign your classification. The reason why that's important is because you can't have any one name be duplicated within any class of goods and services. Okay. But you can have the same name within different classes of goods and services. Just using something that's in the general world, Dove. You can have Dove chocolates. You can also have Dove bath and body products. And they can coexist, and there's no problem, and there's no infringement. Now, if something is similar, you can also get into a problem. So say Dove, the chocolate company, wanted to start making bath and body products under the Dove, maybe it was, you know, chocolate-scented soap or something, under the Dove trademark, then it could potentially have a problem with getting trademark protection there. But generally, as long as you're not duplicating within the same class of goods and services, you should be okay. The reason all of that is also important is when you're choosing a name for your business, you want it to be distinctive. And a lot of folks in the construction industry will name their businesses after their family name or their personal name. But occasionally, somebody wants to stand out. They want to pop out from the herd and say, well, I'm going to create something like, you know, Red Oak Construction. Or, you know, where we are, Wisconsin Construction Company. So then you have to start looking to whether or not that is something that can receive trademark protection. And the USPTO has said that there are various levels of protection available for the distinctiveness of your name, or the name of what you're trying to trademark. So, and this goes all the way from something that's completely ordinary and vanilla to something that's highly unique. And there are four different categories in there of distinctiveness. And so the vanilla is generic stuff. Something like Milwaukee Plumbing. Okay, well, first of all, the USPTO says that geographic designations can't receive trademark protection unless they've achieved a secondary meaning. Because there is a company called Milwaukee Tools that has some trademark protection to the extent that I understand. But generally, if you try to name your company such and such plumbing, such and such, you know, masonry, depending on where you're operating out of, you may not be able to get trademark protection. It's going to be considered generic. But the more unique you get, the better chance you have of protecting things. A fantastic example of that is an Oreo cookie. The word Oreo doesn't in and of itself describe a delicious chocolate and cream filled cookie. It is just a word that's completely independent of it that's gained this distinctiveness over time. And that's also likely why you see a lot of pharmaceutical companies calling themselves names, you know, whatever names you can think of, because they're so distinctive and they can easily obtain copyright protection and not be confused with something else in the marketplace. So, you know, I'm not saying don't name your company after your family name. I'm not saying don't name your company after location where you're at. But if you do, you may have a harder time getting copyright protection, trademark protection for that particular name. But if you've gone off and named something pretty interesting, you know, blue steel erecting for a steel company, it's possible that you could try to get trademark protection and protect that name. And I have argued some of this stuff with companies that had similar names and had to rely on trademark protection so that one person who was trying to come in and essentially create confusion in the marketplace and also take business away in the marketplace was stopped. And the whole reason why you want to have this source designation in trademarks is to avoid confusion. You don't want there to be confusion. And if you can show that somebody is getting actively confused, that helps your case. A case I had some years ago, guy was operating a plumbing company. Another guy came in with a similar name, and my client started getting angry phone calls from customers saying, "Hey, you haven't ever come out to finish your punch list items." And he said, I'm sorry, I have no clue who you are. And they're like, "Well, I've got your invoice right here. I've got, everything, here is saying what you're supposed to do." And he said, "Well, can you send me a copy of that invoice?" When it was the other company, the name was just the exact same. And we were able to say, "Well, no, I'm sorry, you are infringing on our client's trademark and you need to stop and then cease and desist and get out of here." And that happens sometimes because competition is fierce.
Absolutely. So if you obtain trademark protection, that's like throughout all 50 states, right?
So yeah, the trademark at the federal level is throughout all 50 states. There are individual state level trademark protections dependent on the state that you're in. And so for example, in Wisconsin, we do have a separate trademark protection that if maybe you're only operating within this state, you would only go for the state trademark protection, not the federal. Because the key is if you're gonna apply for federal trademark protection, you have to do interstate commerce. You have to be conducting your commerce across state lines between two or more states.
Gotcha. Okay. So what are the benefits of getting trademarked?
So you're excluding others from using that particular name as a source designator. In the example I gave with the plumbing company, someone else was coming in to the same marketplace, to the same customer base, using the exact same name and creating confusion. And because our client had trademark protection over their name, and this what that example was a state trademark protection only, not a federal trademark protection. We were able to use that to tell the other company to stop, and they did because there was
threat. Was it trademark before the incident started, or you trademark it after the incident started? I'm curious.
In that case, it was trademarked beforehand.
Okay, so if somebody comes to you and it's already happening, can they go trademark at that point, or is it too late?
Well, they can. You can trademark anytime you want to.
Gotcha.
It just looks, it can look suspicious at that point. But here's the cool thing about trademarks, just like copyrights, is that you get your trademark through use. The registration just confirms your trademark to the public and to the government.
Gotcha.
You actually get your trademark protection at the federal level and the state level by showing continued use. So you can't just start up one day and say, I've got my trademark protection, and then I'm going into business as of today, and it's the same day I got my trademark protection. You start selling products. You start doing your business. You start selling things. And then you can say, look at my continued use. Because of this continued use, I now have the rights to use this name to the exclusion of all others.
Gotcha. So if you don't want to rely on use and you want to actually have an official trademark, how do you obtain that? Where do you go to file that? What do you do?
So you go to the USPTO, it's the US Patent and Trademark Office. They have a website. They all have also have a physical location in DC, but to file, you go to the website, you create a login, and then you work your way through their website as well. They have a similar, it's a kind of a wizard type website, just like the Copyright Office has. And many attorneys who practice in IP will already have a login that they can use to docket all of their deadlines. You don't need an attorney to apply for copyright or trademarks, but I do recommend that you use an attorney. And the reason being is, especially with the copyright website is fairly intuitive. The trademark website, however, has just a ton of information compacted into a very small place. Once you get on there and get into the application and start working through it, it's dense. And if you miss something and you file your application incorrectly, you've waived your fees. And the filing fee is, if you're using what's called TEAS Plus, which is where you are using an existing category of goods and services, it's a $250 filing fee per class. So say you want to register in two classes, it's a $500 filing fee. If you're creating your own class, then it's a $350 filing fee. And that's independent of whatever you're paying your attorney. So I did have an unfortunate client come to me a couple years ago who tried to do their own application, and they just, something happened. I think it was a glitch on the USPTO side, but they never would admit it. Because the client was located in North Carolina, and the application said they were in the U.S. Virgin Islands. And my argument to the USPTO was, my client knows where they exist. They've been there for 20 years. It must be a glitch. But the USPTO wouldn't budge, and you really have two options. One is more legal fees or just refile. But in that case, the client had to refile and waive the initial filing fee. And so sometimes it does help to have an attorney go through these things with you and go through that application. The warning I will give you is that it's a long process from application to approval. I just last week received a notice of publication. Publication is a process in the trademark within the trademark process where a trademark is put into an electronic gazette. It used to be a paper gazette, but it's a gazette where other attorneys will review it to see if there's something that may be potentially infringing on their client's marks, and then they can file an objection. And if they don't file an objection, then the trademark passes through. So this particular mark was filed on August 6th of 2021, and it's up for publication now on June 14th of 2022. So it is a long process.
Just like any other government process.
Yes.
Okay, so is there anything I missed on the importance of trademarks?
Well, I know we talked about registering and the benefits of it. You don't need to register, but registering does give you that evidence that it's yours. The nice thing about trademarks that's different from copyrights, copyrights have a certain time period. Trademarks will last for as long as you're using them, but you do have to renew them every 10 years. I have had some clients lose their trademark rights and have to reapply and go through the entire process over again because they just forgot to renew.
And so you'd have to check with your state to see if your state offers state trademarks.
Correct.
Very cool. Okay, so what about patents? What can be patented?
Yeah, so patents are something that you're going to have to go through an attorney who does patents specifically. But think inventions and any method of doing business. So everything from a fishing lure to a machine is something that can be patented. And the benefits of obtaining patent protection are that you get to exclude others from using it for a period of 20 years. Then at that 20-year mark, it goes in the public domain. That's why when you go to, say, a drugstore and you see Tylenol, and then right next to it, there's the such and such brand, that if you flip the boxes over, they're the exact same active ingredients and inactive ingredients, because that drug was patented for a period of 20 years, slipped into the public domain, and at that moment, everybody else could use it and sell it for a smaller price. So, but you get to tie it up for that period of time, build your brand for that period of time, and then use it to the exclusion of every other person. Theoretically, in that 20-year time, you're amassing a lot out of it. But it can be expensive. I don't personally practice in patents, but it, you know, a patent application can be a $10,000 investment. So you want to make sure that you do it correctly. The big takeaway from patents, I know we're running a little short on time, is basically to ensure that you do that with a patent attorney. You could theoretically do it by yourself, but you really need to go through a patent attorney to
I agree. That's something. This is like the first time I'm, besides law school, I guess, in practice, that I'm really realizing the difference between these things and how they all work. I don't think I ever took patents and trademarks in law school. I think that was an elective. okay, so trade secrets. I'm interested to hear about this one.
Sure, sure.
What are trade secrets?
Yeah, so trade secrets are something that you are able to use to the exclusion of all others by virtue of keeping it secret. Now, that can be, especially in construction, very important. Your customer lists, your pricing, your method of doing business and marketing. As long as you keep that to the exclusion of all others, and only to a select number of people within your organization, you can assert trade secret protection. You don't register with anybody. There's no governmental oversight. You basically say it's ours because we've kept it a secret. And the more controls you put on it internally, the better an argument you have for keeping it a trade secret. So agreements between your principals and the people who have access to it. Maybe a locked safe. Maybe that only a few people have the combination or key to. A need to know basis is essential, and you would keep that locked down with certain passwords, maybe, you know, access points, either virtually or physically. And the more protections you can show, the better. If something happens, the better for you. What you don't want to have happen, and I've seen this all too many times, is for you to create the coolest thing that's going to make your business boom and have one of your disgruntled employees, or maybe just an employee who doesn't know any better, go and leave, take your customer list, take your pricing, take your cool thing, and then go and start up their own thing. What you're left with is a decision, A, do I file a lawsuit, which you're probably going to have to exclude them from doing that further, or do I continue and do I compete with them? You're not going to want to compete if you developed it.
Yeah.
And when you go in front of the court's going to look at all of those protections that you put into place. Did you have an agreement with your employees? Did you have it behind a locked door or in a safe? Or was it something that the entire company just had access to? I had a case like this in front of a judge once who asked whether or not our client had a non-compete and a confidentiality agreement with its employees. It did not. And the reason it did not was because in Wisconsin, non-competes are construed very narrowly and very rarely enforced. At the appellate level, I don't think in the last 40 years a single non-compete has been approved. And so the client said, well, if they're never going to be enforced anyway, what's the point?
Yeah.
And I agree. Theoretically, I agree. But this particular judge, the first question out of his mouth was there a non-compete? Was there a confidentiality agreement? And we had to answer honestly that there was not. And even though I tried to say the rationale for it was that in our state, they are very rarely enforceable, that didn't matter. The judge got it in his head that our client just didn't care about its IP enough, that had it cared, it would have locked it down some other way, via an agreement at the very least. So this really goes for, I mean, the trade secrets are what you want to make of them, but they have to go to your methods, your processes, things that are special. They can't be things in the public domain. They can't be things that everybody knows about. That's why I talk about customer lists and pricing and special ways of doing things. Maybe you created a special composite that is unique to your industry and you want to lock that up. And you don't let anybody have it. And make sure that your IT folks put special protections in make sure that your employees are only using company computers, company handheld devices. Don't use their Gmail, because I've tried to get stuff from Google and they won't give it to you. And don't let everybody have access to it. Keep it to a select amount of people and only on a need to know basis. And that's how you maintain your trade secrets.
So for like a process manual or something like that for a certain department, could you put it on the manual itself that this is a trade secret and not to be shared? Would that be effective? Or kind of, maybe not.
If you label something as a trade secret and you limit it only to a certain amount of people, yes. But if you're leaving it out in the conference room, the judge is going to say, look, yeah, you put something on it. You said it was confidential, but you must not have thought it was too confidential because you left it in the conference room.
Gotcha. And I know, like, non-competes, you normally have to be in writing and you have to give independent consideration for that. And I think just the way across the country non-competes are on their way out with the new Biden administration taking a look at them independently, I just don't think that's something at any level that's going to be much longer, and you know, a thing. But what about the confidentiality? And if you put, like, in your handbook that, you know, everything you see here or whatever is confidential or something like that, would that be effective?
Yeah, it helps. I mean, all of that helps to the degree that you write things, to the degree that you memorialize things. But you also have to take those extra steps. You know, if it's something that, you know, that you truly want to lock up, a pricing list, a customer list, keep that behind a password wall. Keep that to a need-to-know group of people that the average person walking into your office can't get. And it honestly doesn't matter how big of a company you are, how small of a company you are. Your trade secrets can be as important as you want them to be. And I've had, you know, three-person shops have very significant trade secrets because that's their bread and butter. Mm-hmm. In that case, maybe only one out of the three has access to the trade secrets, or two in case the one guy dies.
Gotcha.
But they keep it to the exclusion of the other, you know, the administrative assistant. And that's how they say, hey, look, the administrative assistant doesn't have the access, but the two principals do.
Gotcha. Anything else on trade secrets that I may have missed?
No, that's about it. Trade secrets are admittedly fluid. And, you know, sometimes people will say that something's a trade secret that's not really. It's really a case-by-case basis. And what I recommend is talking with your attorney and getting a litmus test of whether or not something is actually a trade secret. They're also of estate creation. And so what is and what is not a trade secret may vary depending on what state you're located in.
A little bit by a little bit. Gotcha. Okay. And so then what if somebody has all this and then somebody infringes on those rights? Like, you know, it's a company and they start acting out and start doing business in your name, or, you know, taking pictures off your website or stuff like that. What do you do then?
Well, the first thing you're going to do is go to your attorney and identify what it is. And develop a plan of action. A lot of times things start with a cease and desist, and oftentimes the cease and desist is not responded to. It's just ignored. And then you're left with the decision of whether or not you're going to file a lawsuit to enforce those rights. And if you have done everything correctly, like we talked about in this, you know, last hour here, your lawsuit should be fairly straightforward. I mean, if you can prove without any doubt that you own something and somebody else has infringed upon it, then great. Your lawsuit should be fairly simple. Reality, however, there's a lot of gray area and a lot of folks who don't protect their IP. And that's where you have your disputes. And so really every step along the way, I do recommend clients working in conjunction with their attorneys to try to lock things up on any of these IP sides and make sure that they have protections in place, because you never want to be in a lawsuit. So if you can put your protections in place on the front end, hopefully it'll help you on the back end.
So, and then if you have like something like a trademark or a copyright, could you, like, if you're going to file a lawsuit, could you move forward with like a temporary restraining order or something to stop them from doing that while a pendency of the lawsuit's going on?
You can file for it. And depending on what the judge, you know, what the evidence is, the judge may or may not grant it. That one case I was talking about with where the judge looked at the absence of a confidentiality agreement, that was on a motion for temporary restraining order. And the judge wasn't too keen to give that because they didn't really see that the client had established that there was a trade secret in place. And so you really want to look at your facts and try to see how much you can do to protect yourself on the front end before you get to that lawsuit. Because the last thing you want is a judge saying, I'm sorry, I'm not going to give you your TRO because you haven't done enough to protect your trademark or your copyright or your trade secret.
Well, and the thing too is that this is not something a judge deals with every day, just like construction law in general, but then you throw in IP law, whatever, you know, PI, personal injury, they deal with every day, but the other. My goodness, thank you for all this great information. I learned a lot, and I didn't realize how important it was in the construction industry. So if people wanted to find you, if they had specific questions, where could they find you? Where could they reach out to you?
Sure, yeah. You can Google Brian Cruz. My name is spelled K-R-O-E-S, and then Brian with a Y. The firm is Hurtado Zimmerman SC, H-U-R-T-A-D-O, Zimmerman, common spelling, S as in Sam, C as in Charles. And you can find us on the web. I have some articles about IP and construction up on the web. My email is also up there. It's basically my first initial last name, bcruz at, and then hzatty.com. So I'm fairly accessible. If people have questions, always happy to talk to folks about this stuff.
Awesome. And we'll also put your all of your information in the show notes. I appreciate you being here so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for having me.
Thanks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Quit Getting Screwed. I hope you found it helpful. If you like what you hear, please like us and follow our podcast. If you want further information, you can find us at subcontractorinstitute.com. We're also on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Instagram. And the book is available on Amazon. Thank you.